I complied more to oblige her, and to while away a tedious hour. I thought a good deal on what I witnessed, and I determined to investigate the matter and find out what it was. If it was a deception, or a delusion, I thought that I could detect it. For about 4 months I devoted at least 2 evenings in a week and sometimes more to witnessing the phenomena in all its phases. I kept careful records of all I witnessed, and from time to time compared them with each other, to detect inconsistencies and contradictions. I read all I could lay my hands on the subject, and especially all the professed exposures of the humbug. I went from place to place, seeing different mediums, meeting with different parties of persons, often with persons whom I had never seen before, and sometimes where I was myself entirely unknown, sometimes in the dark and sometimes in the light, too often with inveterate unbelievers, and more frequently with zealous believers. In fine, I availed myself of every opportunity that was afforded, thoroughly to sift the matter to the bottom. I was all this time an unbeliever, and tried the patience of believers sorely by my skepticism, my captiousness, and my obdurate refusal to yield my belief. I saw around me some who yielded a ready faith on 1 or 2 sittings only, others again, under the same circumstances, avowing a determined unbelief, and some who refused to witness it at all, and yet were confirmed unbelievers. I could not imitate either of these parties, and refused to yield unless upon most irrefragable testimony. At length the evidence came, and in such force that no sane man could withhold his faith. It will thus be seen that this, the earliest outstanding convert to the new revelation, took the utmost pains before he allowed the evidence to convince him of the validity of the claims of the Spirit. General experience shows that a facile acceptance of these claims is very rare among earnest thinkers, and that there is hardly any prominent spiritualist whose course of study and reflection has not involved a novitiate of many years. This forms a striking contrast to those negative opinions which are founded upon initial prejudice and the biased or scandalous accounts of partisan authors. Judge Edmonds, in the excellent summary of his position given in the article already quoted, an article which should have converted the whole American people had they been ready for assimilation, proceeds to show the solid basis of his beliefs. He points out that he was never alone when these manifestations occurred, and that he had many witnesses. He also shows the elaborate precautions which he took, after depending upon my senses, as to these various phases of the phenomenon. I invoked the aid of science, and, with the assistance of an accomplished electrician and his machinery, and 8 or 10 intelligent, educated, shrewd persons, examined the matter. We pursued our inquiries many days, and established to our satisfaction 2 things. First, that the sounds were not produced by the agency of any person present or near us, and, second, that they were not forthcoming at our will and pleasure. He deals faithfully with the alleged exposures in newspapers, some of which at long intervals are true indictments of some villain, but which usually are greater deceptions, conscious or unconscious, of the public than the evils which they profess to attack. Thus, while these things were going on, there appeared in the newspapers various explanations and exposures of the humbug, as they were termed. I read them with care, in the expectation of being assisted in my researches, and I could not but smile at once at the rashness and the futility of the explanations. For instance, while certain learned professors in Buffalo were congratulating themselves on having detected it in the toe and knee joints, the manifestations in this city changed to ringing a bell placed under the table. They were like the solution lately given by a learned professor in England, who attributes the tipping of tables to a force in the hands which are laid upon them, overlooking the material fact that tables quite as frequently move when there is no hand upon them. Having dealt with the objectivity of the phenomena, the judge next touched upon the more important question of their source. He commented upon the fact that he had answers to mental questions and found that his own secret thoughts were revealed, and that purposes which he had privily entertained had been made manifest. He notes also that he had heard the mediums use Greek, Latin, Spanish, and French, when they were ignorant of these languages. This drives him to the consideration of whether these things may not be explained as the reflection of the mind of some other living human being. These considerations have been exhausted by every inquirer in turn, for spiritualists do not accept their creed in one bound, but make the journey step by step, with much timid testing of the path. Judge Edmonds's epitome of his course is but that which many others have followed. He gives the following reasons for negativing this question of other human minds. Facts were communicated which were unknown then, but afterward found to be true, like this. For instance, when I was absent last winter in Central America, my friends in town heard of my whereabouts and of the state of my health 7 times, and on my return, by comparing their information with the entries in my journal, it was found to be invariably correct. So, in my recent visit to the West, my whereabouts and my condition were told to a medium in this city, while I was traveling on the railroad between Cleveland and Toledo. So thoughts have been uttered on subjects not then in my mind, and utterly at variance with my own notions. This has often happened to me and to others, so as fully to establish the fact that it was not our minds that gave birth to or effected the communication. He then deals with the object of this marvelous development, and he points out its overwhelming religious significance on the general lines with which it is defined in a subsequent chapter of this work. Judge Edmonds's brain was indeed a remarkable one, and his judgment clear, for there is very little which we can add to his statement, and perhaps it has never been so well expressed in so small a compass. As we point to it, one can claim that spiritualism has been consistent from the first, and that the teachers and guides have not mixed their message. It is a strange and an amusing reflection that the arrogant science which endeavored by its mere word and glare to crush this upstart knowledge in 1850 has been proved to be essentially wrong on its own ground. There are hardly any scientific axioms of that day: the finality of the element, the indivisibility of the atom, the separate origin of species, which have not been controverted, whereas the psychic knowledge which was so derided has steadily held its own, adding fresh facts but never contradicting those which were originally put forward. Writing of the beneficent effects of this knowledge, the judge says, "There is that which comforts the mourner and binds up the broken-hearted, that which smooths the passage to the grave and robs death of its terrors, that which enlightens the atheist and cannot but reform the vicious, that which cheers and encourages the virtuous amid all the trials and vicissitudes of life, and that which demonstrates to man his duty and his destiny, leaving it no longer vague and uncertain." The matter has never been better summed up than that. There is, however, one final passage in this remarkable document which causes some sadness. Speaking of the progress which the movement had made within 4 years in the United States, he says, "There are 10 or 12 newspapers and periodicals devoted to the cause, and the spiritual library embraces more than 100 different publications, some of which have already attained a circulation of more than 10,000 copies. Besides the undistinguished multitude, there are many men of high standing and talent ranked among them, doctors, lawyers, and clergymen in great numbers, a Protestant bishop, the learned and reverend president of a college, judges of our higher courts, members of Congress, foreign ambassadors and ex-members of the United States Senate. In 4 years, the spirit force had done as much as this. How does the matter stand today? The undistinguished multitude has carried bravely on, and the 100 publications have grown into many more, but where are the men of light and leading who point the path? Since the death of Professor Hislop, it is difficult to point to one man of eminence in the United States who is ready to stake his career and reputation upon the issue. Those who would have never feared the tyranny of man have shrank from the catcalling of the public press. The printing machine has succeeded where the rack would have failed. The worldly loss in reputation and in business sustained by Judge Edmonds himself, who had to resign his seat upon the Supreme Court of New York, and by many others who testified to the truth, established a reign of terror which warns the intellectual classes from the subject. So the matter stands at present. But the press, for the moment, was well disposed, and Judge Edmonds's famous summing up, perhaps the finest and most momentous that any judge has ever delivered, met with respect, if not with concurrence. The New York Courier wrote, "The letter from Judge Edmonds, published by us on Saturday, with regard to the so-called spiritual manifestations, coming as it did from an eminent jurist, a man remarkable for his clear common sense in the practical affairs of life, and a gentleman of irreproachable character, arrested the attention of the community, and is regarded by many persons as one of the most remarkable documents of the day." The New York Evening Mirror said, "John W. Edmonds, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for this district, is an able lawyer, an industrious judge and a good citizen. For the last 8 years occupying without interruption the highest judicial stations, whatever may be his faults, no one can justly accuse him of lack of ability, industry, honesty or fearlessness. No one can doubt his general saneness, or can believe for a moment that the ordinary operations of his mind are not as rapid, accurate and reliable as ever. Both by the practitioners and suitors at his bar he is recognized as the head, in fact and in merit, of the Supreme Court for this district. The experience of Dr. Robert Hare, professor of chemistry in the University of Pennsylvania, is also of interest, because he was one of the first eminent men of science who, setting out to expose the delusion of spiritualism, became finally a firm believer. It was in 1853 that, in his own words, he felt called upon, as an act of duty to his fellow creatures, to bring whatever influence he possessed to the attempt to stem the tide of popular madness which, in defiance of reason and science, was fast setting in favor of the gross delusion called spiritualism." A denunciatory letter of his published in the newspapers of Philadelphia, where he lived, was copied by other newspapers all over the country, and it was made the text of numerous sermons. But, as with Sir William Crookes many years later, the jubilation was premature. Professor Hare, though a strong skeptic, was induced to experiment for himself, and after a period of careful testing he became entirely convinced of the spiritual origin of the manifestations. Like Crookes, he devised apparatus for use with mediums. Mr. S.B. Britton, editor of the Spiritual Telegraph, gives the following condensed account of some of Hare's experiments. First, to satisfy himself that the movements were not the works of mortals, he took brass billiard balls, placed them on zinc plates and placed the hands of the mediums on the balls and, to his very great astonishment, the tables moved. He next arranged a table to slide backward and forward, to which attachments were made, causing a disc to revolve containing the alphabet, hidden from the view of the mediums. The letters were variously arranged, out of their regular consecutive order, and the spirit was required to place them consecutively or in their regular places. And behold, it was done. Then followed intelligent sentences which the medium could not see or know the import of till they were told him. Again he tried another capital test. The long end of a lever was placed on spiral scales with an index attached and the weight marked, the medium's hand rested on the short end of the beam, where it was impossible to give pressure downward, but if pressed it would have a contrary effect and raise the long end, and yet, most astounding, the weight was increased several pounds on the scale. Professor Hare embodied his careful researches and his views on spiritualism in an important book published in New York in 1855, entitled Experimental Investigation of the Spirit Manifestations. In this, p. 55, he sums up the results of his early experiments as follows: "The evidence of the manifestations adduced in the foregoing narrative does not rest upon myself only, since there have been persons present when they were observed, and they have in my presence been repeated essentially under various modifications in many instances not specially alluded to. The evidence may be contemplated under various phases. First, those in which rappings or other noises have been made which could not be traced to any mortal agency. Secondly, those in which sounds were so made as to indicate letters forming grammatical, well-spelt sentences, affording proof that they were under the guidance of some rational being. Thirdly, those in which the nature of the communication has been such as to prove that the being causing them must, agreeably to accompanying allegations, be some known acquaintance, friend, or relative of the inquirer. Again, cases in which movements have been made of ponderable bodies of a nature to produce intellectual communications resembling those obtained, as above mentioned, by sounds. Although the apparatus by which these various proofs were attained with the greatest possible precaution and precision, modified them as to the manner, essentially all the evidence which I have obtained tending to the conclusions above mentioned, has likewise been substantially obtained by a great number of observers. Many who never sought any spiritual communication and have not been induced to enroll themselves as spiritualists, will nevertheless not only affirm the existence of the sounds and movements, but also admit their inscrutability. Mr. James J. Mapes, LL.D., of New York, an agricultural chemist and member of various learned societies, commenced his investigation into spiritualism in order to rescue, as he said, his friends, who were running to imbecility over the new craze. Through the mediumship of Mrs. Cora Hatch, afterwards Mrs. Richmond, he received what are described as marvelous scientific answers to his questions. He ended by becoming a thorough believer, and his wife, who had no artistic talent, became a drawing and painting medium. His daughter had, unknown to him, become a writing medium, and when she spoke to him about this development, he asked her to give him an exhibition of her power. She took a pen and rapidly wrote what professed to be a message from Professor Mapes's father. The professor asked for a proof of identity. His daughter's hand at once wrote, "You may recollect that I gave you, among other books, an encyclopedia. Look at page 120 of that book, and you will find my name written there, which you have never seen." The book referred to was stored with others at a warehouse. When Professor Mapes opened the case, which had been undisturbed for 27 years, to his astonishment he found his father's name written on page 120. It was this incident which first led him to make a serious investigation, for, like his friend Professor Hare, he had up till that time been a strong materialist. In April, 1854, the Honorable James Shields presented a memorial, praying for inquiry, to the United States Legislature, with 13,000 signatures attached, and with the name of Governor Tallmadge at the head of the list. After a frivolous discussion, in which Mr. Shields, who presented the petition, referred to the belief held by the petitioners as due to a delusion arising from defective education or deranged mental faculties, it was formally agreed that the petition should lie upon the table. Mr. E. W. Capron has this comment, see Capron, Modern Spiritualism, pages 359-363. Modern Spiritualism, p. 375. Modern Spiritualism, p. 197. It is not probable that any of the memorialists expected more favorable treatment than they received. The carpenters and fishermen of the world are the ones to investigate new truths and make senates and crowns believe and respect them. It is in vain to look for the reception or respect of new truths by men in high places. The first regular spiritualist organization was formed in New York on June 10, 1854. It was entitled the Society for the Diffusion of Spiritual Knowledge, and included among its members such prominent people as Judge Edmonds and Governor Tallmadge, of Wisconsin. Among the activities of the society was the establishment of a newspaper called The Christian Spiritualist, and the engagement of Miss Kate Fox to hold daily S.A. copyright answers, to which the public were admitted free each morning from 10 till 1 o'clock. Writing in 1855, Capron says, "It would be impossible to state particulars in regard to the spread of spiritualism in New York up to the present time. It has become diffused throughout the city, and has almost ceased to be a curiosity or a wonder to any. Public meetings are regularly held, and the investigation is constantly going on, but the days of excitement on the subject have passed away, and all parties look upon it as, at least, something more than a mere trick. It is true that religious bigotry denounces it, but without disputing the occurrences, and occasionally a pretended expose is made for purposes of speculation, but the fact of spiritual intercourse has become an acknowledged fact in the Empire City. Perhaps the most significant fact of the period we have been considering was the development of mediumship in prominent people, as, for instance, Judge Edmonds and Professor Hare. The latter writes, "Having latterly acquired the powers of a medium in a sufficient degree to interchange ideas with my spirit friends, I am no longer under the necessity of defending media from the charge of falsehood and deception. It is now my own character only that can be in question." Experimental Investigation of the Spirit Manifestations, p. 54. Thus, dismissing the Fox Girls from the field altogether, we have the private mediumship of Reverend A. H. Jervis, Deacon Hale, Lyman Granger, Judge Edmonds, Professor Hare, Mrs. Mapes, Miss Mapes, and the public mediumship of Mrs. Tamlin, Mrs. Benedict, Mrs. Hayden, D.D. Home, and dozens of others. It is not within the scope of this work to deal with the great number of individual cases of mediumship, some of them most dramatic and interesting, which occurred during this first period of demonstration. The reader is referred to Mrs. Harding Britton's two important compilations, Modern American Spiritualism and 19th Century Miracles, books which will always be a most valuable record of early days. The series of phenomenal cases was so great that Mrs. Britton has counted over 5,000 separate instances recorded in the press in the first few years, which probably represents some hundreds of thousands not so recorded. Religion so-called and science so-called united for once in an unholy attempt to misrepresent and persecute the new truth and its supporters, while the press unfortunately found that its interest lay in playing up to the prejudices of the majority of its subscribers. It was easy to do this, for naturally, in so vital and compelling a movement, there were some who became fanatical, some who threw discredit upon their opinions by their actions, and some who took advantage of the general interest to imitate, with more or less success, the real gifts of the spirit. These fraudulent rascals were sometimes mere cold-blooded swindlers, and sometimes seemed to have been real mediums whose psychic power had for a time deserted them. There were scandals and exposures, some real and some pretended. These exposures were then, as now, due often to the spiritualists themselves, who strongly objected to their sacred ceremonies being a screen for the hypocrisies and blasphemies of those villains who, like human hyenas, tried to make a fraudulent living out of the dead. The general result was to take the edge off the first fine enthusiasm, and to set back the acceptance of what was true by an eternal harping on what was false. The brave report of Professor Hare led to a disgraceful persecution of that venerable savant, who was at that moment, with the exception of Agassiz, the best-known man of science in America. The professors of Harvard, a university which has a most unenviable record in psychic matters, a passed a resolution denouncing him and his insane adherence to a gigantic humbug. He could not lose his professorial chair at Pennsylvania University because that had been already resigned, but he suffered much in loss of reputation. The crowning and most absurd instance of scientific intolerance, an intolerance which has always been as violent and unreasonable as that of the medieval church, was shown by the American Scientific Association. This learned body howled down Professor Hare when he attempted to address them, and put it on record that the subject was unworthy of their attention. It was remarked, however, by the spiritualists, that the same society at the same session held an animated debate as to why cocks crow between 12 and 1 at night, coming finally to the conclusion that at that particular hour a wave of electricity passes over the earth from north to south, and that the fowls, disturbed out of their slumbers and being naturally of a crowing disposition, register the event in this fashion. It had not then been learned, and perhaps it has hardly been learned yet, that a man, or a body of men, may be very wise upon those subjects on which they are experts, and yet show an extraordinary want of common sense when faced with a new proposition which calls for a complete readjustment of ideas. British science and, indeed, science the whole world over, have shown the same intolerance and want of elasticity which marked those early days in America. These days have been drawn so fully by Mrs. Harding Britton, who herself played a large part in them, that those who are interested can always follow them in her pages. Some notes about Mrs. Britton herself may, however, be fitly introduced at this place, for no history of spiritualism could be complete without an account of this remarkable woman who has been called the female Saint Paul of the movement. She was a young English woman who had gone to New York with a theatrical company, and had then, with her mother, remained in America. Being strictly evangelical, she was much repelled by what she considered the unorthodox views of spiritualists, and fled in horror from her first essay Tilda Copyright Dance. Later, in 1856, she was again brought into contact with the subject and received proofs which made it impossible for her to doubt its truth. She soon discovered that she was herself a powerful medium, and one of the best attested and most sensational cases in the early history of the movement was that in which she received intimation that the mail steamer Pacific had gone down in mid-Atlantic with all souls, and was threatened with prosecution by the owners of the boat for repeating what had been told her by the returning spirit of one of the crew. The information proved to be only too true, and the vessel was never heard of again. Mrs. Emma Harding G.A., who became, by a second marriage, Mrs. Harding Britton, threw her whole enthusiastic temperament into the young movement and left a mark upon it which is still visible. She was an ideal propagandist, for she combined every gift. She was a strong medium, an orator, a writer, a well-balanced thinker and a hardy traveler. Year after year she traveled the length and breadth of the United States proclaiming the new doctrine amid much opposition, for she was militant and anti-Christian in the views which she professed to get straight from her spirit guides. As these views were, however, that the morals of the churches were far too lax and that a higher standard was called for, it is not likely that the founder of Christianity would have been among her critics. These opinions of Mrs. Harding Britton had more to do with the broadly Unitarian view of the official spiritualist bodies, which still exists, than any other cause. In 1866 she returned to England, where she worked indefatigably, producing her two great chronicles, Modern American Spiritualism and, later, 19th Century Miracles, both of which show an amazing amount of research together with a very clear and logical mind. In 1870 she married Drive Britton, as strong a spiritualist as herself. The marriage seems to have been an ideally happy one. In 1878 they went together as missionaries for spiritualism to Australia and New Zealand, and stayed there for several years, founding various churches and societies which the author found still holding their own when he visited the Antipodes 40 years later upon the same errand. While in Australia she wrote her Faiths, Facts and Frauds of Religious History, a book which still influences many minds. There was at that time undoubtedly a close connection between the free thought movement and the new spirit revelation. The Honourable Robert Stout, Attorney General of New Zealand, was both president of the Free Thought Association and an ardent spiritualist. It is more clearly understood now, however, that spirit intercourse and teaching are too wide to be fitted into any system, whether negative or positive, and that it is possible for a spiritualist to profess any creed so long as he has the essentials of reverence to the unseen and unselfishness to those around him. Among other monuments of her energy, Mrs. Harding Britton founded the Two Worlds of Manchester, which has still as large a circulation as any spiritualistic paper in the world. She passed onwards in 1899, having left her mark deep upon the religious life of three continents. This has been a long but necessary digression from the account of the early days of American progress. Those early days were marked by great enthusiasm, much success, and also considerable persecution. All the leaders who had anything to lose lost it. Mrs. Harding says, Judge Edmonds was pointed at in the streets as a crazy spiritualist. Wealthy merchants were compelled to assert their claims to be considered sane and maintain their commercial rights by the most firm and determined action. Professional men and tradesmen were reduced to the limits of ruin, and a relentless persecution, originated by the press and maintained by the pulpit, directed the full flow of its evil tides against the cause and its representatives.